Good morning and welcome to The Constitution Matters. It is January 23rd, 2015. Michael Evans with you this morning on 1180 WFYL, working for your liberty and things that matter. Thank you so much for listening this morning. We've got Sam Rohr and Gary Porter on the phone with us this morning. Gentlemen, if you would like to go ahead and introduce yourselves to our listeners this morning, I think they'd be glad to hear your voices.
Well, go ahead, Sam. Why don't you start out?
All right. Well, as we hear the music phase out, Gary and Michael did be with us all this morning. And this is Constitution Matters. As Michael said, this is Sam Rohr. I'm president of the Pennsylvania Pastors Network and the American Pastors Network. And joined by fellow guest Gary Porter from Virginia. So, Gary, why don't you begin and set this program going this morning?
Well, great. As Mike said, I'm Gary Porter. I'm the executive director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative down here in Yorktown, Virginia. And we provide classes on the Constitution and the Virginia Constitution, for that matter, to better equip U.S. citizens to stand by their rights and know what those rights are and the view that the founders took of those rights. And I am really, really pleased to be a part of this show. The Constitution does matter, and it will cease to matter when we have reached the point of total tyranny in this country. But for the time being, it matters, and everyone needs to take a personal ownership of that great document. I liken it to your brand new car keys. You just bought a brand new, very expensive car. You don't give those keys to someone you don't know, someone you don't trust, someone you know who's not trained to drive safely. You guard those car keys quite strongly, and so the same should hold to our Constitution. We should be very, very jealous of who we give the keys of our government to and who we allow to operate our Constitution.
And, of course, some people don't think that that's valuable anymore. I'm sure we're definitely going to get into that. Of course, thank you, gentlemen, for joining us this morning. And, Gary, I understand that you've got a feature you would like to begin to share with us to start off our program. We've got a topic. Do not worry. We're going to get into it. Constitutional nullification. But before we do that, Gary, why don't you go ahead and tell us about the Constitution Week in Review and what that's all about.
Right. This is something that I've started doing with my email subscribers, and that is a little review of the week's of the Constitution. And if you subscribe to certain news feeds, you can keep abreast of what's happening in terms of constitutional news, things that aren't going to make it to the front page of your newspaper, your local newspaper, or even the New York Times. But there's a lot happening every week that affects the Constitution or affects our understanding of it or our personal liberties and freedoms. So I just wanted to give a brief summary of some of the things that I've written about in this week's review.
Well, if you please would do, sir, we would all love to hear it.
Well, yes. There's been an issue long growing over the access that police have to information incident to a traffic stop. For instance, we carry around now in our cell phones probably more information than existed in the world in 1787. And so when police stop you for some incident, some broken taillight or something like that, in some instances they felt free to examine your cell phone, and sometimes they found information that has led them to charge you with other crimes. And so the Supreme Court last June ruled 9-0 that was an illegal search, that police needed a warrant, a specific warrant, before they could search things like your cell phone or a laptop computer that they encountered incident to some other encounter. Well, here in Virginia, some patriots have taken that a step further, and they have introduced a bill in the Virginia legislature. And the reason I'm suggesting, even talking about this, is that certainly every state could do this as well. And that proposed constitutional amendment would institutionalize that right, that it would make it beyond reach of the police, that they would need a specific warrant to search any cell phone or electronic device before, you know, they could use any information that they discovered on that. So that's an avenue that I think people often overlook, is that you have state constitutions that protect your rights in some cases to an even greater extent than the national constitution, the U.S. Constitution, does. And so I encourage people to read their state constitutions. They're always out there on the web somewhere where you can find them. And in some cases, there are even courses that they can take on their state constitution to learn it better. For instance, Maryland residents can take a course conducted or developed by the Institute on the Constitution down in Pasadena, Maryland. And they can learn what their Maryland Constitution originally said, how the founders of Maryland put it together, and what specific protections it has for rights that may be different than the national constitution. And the same thing holds true. We do the same thing here in Virginia. The Constitution Leadership Initiative has a Virginia state constitution course. And, of course, in Pennsylvania there, I'm sure that if a course doesn't exist, one could be put together pretty quickly. And people need to know their state constitution as well as the national constitution. So that's just one instance that has happened in the news recently, and I encourage people to subscribe to news sources that will keep them apprised of what is happening in ways that CNN or NBC or ABC may not be aware of. Another instance, 2 weeks ago in King, North Carolina, there was a lawsuit filed by Americans United for Church of State, Separation of Church and State, and it ordered the King, North Carolina City Council to remove from public land a little statue of a soldier kneeling before a cross. And the organization was vehement that this established religion and that this was therefore a violation of the First Amendment. And unfortunately, the King, North Carolina City Council rolled over on this, and they not only agreed to remove the statue from public land, but they agreed to pay Americans United for Separation of Church and State $500,000 for their trouble in putting together this lawsuit. And that points to what I think is a rather ubiquitous constitutional illiteracy. We just don't understand our Constitution, and we don't certainly understand it the way the founders did, and we need to get back to that. We need to understand our Constitution from the founders' perspective, and we need to stand up for the rights that it secures. Just as Jefferson said, the reason for government is to secure our rights, and we need to stand up for that. So there's a couple of news items that people may not have been aware of if they have only gotten their news off of CNN this week.
Well, yeah, and, well, of course, thanks for bringing that to our attention. The Constitution Week in Review. My goodness, yeah, it's $500,000 for a soldier kneeling before a cross, that was not separation of church and state, that was a violation of the Constitution, which, of course, we're all here to talk about this morning, maybe not necessarily that one topic. But why don't we go ahead and, I guess, transition a little bit towards our topic. Sam, I'm sure you have some things to say, commenting on maybe the Constitution's Week in Review, or we could just jump right into the topic.
Well, Michael, I do. And just to follow up, I think, on what Gary was talking about, because as listeners listen to this conversation, sometimes it's hard to understand, for instance, the average person in America, whether they are a believing Christian or a constitutional, you know, patriot, or just a good patriotic American, would look at that example that Gary gave down there in North Carolina. And those kind of things have happened on a number of circumstances across many states over some time by such groups as ACLU or Americans United for Separation of Church and State, and there's a few other ones out there like that. And you wonder, how in the world is it? Why is it that those kind of things happen. The average person looks at that at face value and says, that doesn't make sense.
Right.
How can that be? Those have been those examples, crosses on churches or on cemeteries or that kind of thing there that there are, you know, or nativity scenes, all of these things that we've been hearing about. You'd look at, well, we've done that for nearly since the beginning of our country. This is what America is all about. How can that happen? I want to put in one piece here. I think it is in part because, yes, the average person does not understand perhaps the Constitution, but the average person, I think, does understand it enough to know that that doesn't make sense. What they don't understand is how a challenge, off-the-wall challenge, from groups like Americans United for Separation of Church and State can actually happen with local elected people. And I want to put out one thing I've mentioned before in this program. What's happened is that the legal system, those who are there who are actually on the ground defenders of law and local elected officials, and I would say even elected officials, even up the ladder into state government and others, if they are of a persuasion that their primary obligation is to avoid conflict, or let's put it this way, reduce the element of risk, they will counsel those in charge. I can guarantee you in no places like that, it probably was not just the local township or borough officials. It was the solicitor that was in there, that the one who's hired to tell them their legal advice, who told them, better settle, better get out. Mm-hmm. You don't want to fight on this one. This is going to be too much. And so more and more and more, these things are settled out of court by just caving in and rolling over because they don't want to fight. I think what this program's about, and what Gary's talking about, we're talking about, is that there are some things when it comes to the matters of freedom that you cannot roll over about. You must stand up and with intelligence and an articulate voice fight for and defend those things which we have, and those things which are defending are, in fact, found within the Constitution. So I would say that really what happens is if somebody's listening who is in an elected position, get someone who is sitting in the position of legal counsel who is more concerned about the Constitution and defending the rights of all of us, including the next generation that's coming along, than simply avoiding a conflict. We're being challenged by many who are wanting to undercut what we have, and we will not maintain what we have unless we're willing to engage and fight. And there's a lot of people out there willing to help defend those kinds of things. I just want to throw that in at this point as we go forward. So, Gary, Mike?
Okay. Yeah, no, I was just going to say, Sam, I mean, you're absolutely right. I mean, I think today in our culture, and this is something, of course, that I believe in the time of the Founding Fathers, and honestly, they didn't have a choice. Our culture is so used to not fighting for things. Not that necessarily fighting, let's say, like war, is necessarily good. It's not a good thing. But sometimes things need to be stood up for, and there needs to be a line drawn at certain points, and we have gotten so used to, in our culture, just capitulating to whatever demands or whatever is the easy way out, and we've done that so much where now we have shows like this, The Constitution Matters, where we come on and say, hey, wait a minute. You know, we have laws, we have principles, things that are important. The Constitution, of course, is one of the most important things for this nation. It's the bedrock of this nation. Even further than that, some people would even say Christianity. I'm a believer of that. I know probably some of us, you know, Sam, you as well, Gary, however your position is on that, but there are underlying principles that are more important, and the more that we capitulate on all these different situations, it's kind of like the slow boil. You know, the frog is sitting there in the pot, and here comes the water turned up. If you put them in a boiling pot of water, they're going to jump right out, but if you just turn it up real nice and slow, they're just going to sit there, and they'll get used to it. But then the problem is, by the time they get used to it, it's boiling, and you don't know where you are. You know? You're completely gone.
Absolutely. And Mike, your reference to principles leads us straight into our next topic, the primary topic for the show this morning, and that is nullification. Nullification is a principle, and it's a principle that people don't really understand very well. But it comes out of the Tenth Amendment. Now, let me read you the Tenth Amendment so we can all be on the same sheet here. the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it to the states, are reserved to the states, respectively, or to the people. Now, that was a very powerful statement. Unfortunately, it didn't go very far. It just describes these unenumerated powers that are reserved by the states or the people. Well, one of those powers is the power of interposition, as James Madison framed it. Interposition is the ability of a state to interpose itself between its citizens and the national government, to protect its citizens from the national government specifically. And this, it all comes from these reserved powers that the states have under the 10th Amendment. So nullification, as it has come to be known, came from a word that Thomas Jefferson used in what were then called the Virginia and Kentucky Resolves. So let's take a trip back to 1798 real quickly and lay the groundwork for this. Then when we come back from the break, I'm going to ask David Whitney, who will hopefully join us from the Institute on the Constitution, to give us some of the successes of the nullification movement. And then we'll finish up, and I'll show some of the limitations of it. But in 1798, John Adams' administration passed what were called the Alien and Sedition Laws. And the Sedition Law was especially egregious because it allowed the government to put in jail and fine anybody who printed or said anything derogatory about the national government. Well, this flew directly in the face of the First Amendment, and everybody understood that there was a challenge there. But the Federalists controlled Congress at the time. Now, by 1798, America had become a very polarized country. You had two political parties that had sprung up, the Federalists, who were in favor of a very strong national government, and the Democratic Republicans, principally under Thomas Jefferson and James Madison, who were in favor of a more states' rights view of the national government and more personal liberty. But unfortunately, the Federalists controlled the government at the time, so they were able to ram through. I think we've seen that happen not too long ago. They've rammed through legislation that was clearly unconstitutional, and yet made it through even a court review. And so this sedition law, which allowed the government to put anybody in jail if they said anything or printed anything derogatory of the government, was opposed by the Democratic Republicans. Now, Thomas Jefferson was the sitting vice president under John Adams. He had lost to John Adams by 3 votes in the election of 1796, and so he was in a pretty precarious position. But he was asked by the residents of Kentucky, which was at that time just a part of Virginia, to consider the constitutional issue involved here. And he wrote what were called the Kentucky Resolves. Ghost wrote them because, as the sitting vice president, he had to be very careful about what he said in public. And James Madison wrote a very companion document called the Virginia Resolves. And both these documents took the view that when Congress passes an unconstitutional law, the states have a right to declare that law null and void under their understanding of the Constitution. So that's where nullification came from. It was the attitude that a state could declare a law of the national government unconstitutional and therefore of no effect within the confines of that state. Now, both the Kentucky and Virginia Resolves, ghostwritten by our two patriots, were sent around to the other states at the time. And unfortunately, the Federalists had a very strong presence in many of those states, and so the idea of nullification did not gain traction at that time. But it has been revived of late, and David, I hope, will go into some of the more recent history of nullification and how it's been used by states to push back on things like federal gun control and Obamacare and the NSA's gathering of metadata of our phone calls and emails, etc.
Right, because that's not federal overreach, right?
No,
not at all. No, that's just protecting us Americans here by the guys who have all the guns that are, you know, they are for us, the federal government. They're just going to collect all of our information and invade all of our privacy. Sorry, I just threw a little bit in there. I mean, you could tell kind of where I stand maybe on that. But I wanted to throw something else at you guys. You know, with nullification, Sam, I think the concern of a lot of Christians maybe when they hear that, you know, nullification of the Constitution, there are laws obviously this country is governed by, and I guess the real question is, Is it expressly permitted in the Constitution from a Christian perspective? Because from a Christian's perspective, Christians, obviously, there is an element where we are to submit to our governing authorities. Sam, your take on that?
Well, that's a good – I mean, we could spend a whole program on that, Michael.
Yeah.
The individual responsibility of let's put it this way. The responsibility of an individual and a citizen as a Christian to laws by civil government are – always in the category where, even in those cases, a Christian is always obligated to obey the higher authority. So whenever civil government authority were to oppose a command by God, for instance, to share the gospel or being able to worship that kind of thing, then they must disobey those laws that violate that higher law. But when you talk about states who are a part of civil government, who under our system are the sovereign states. They have sovereign authority, and they came before the federal government came. They have powers that exist under civil law, granted under the ability of the people of any nation, our nation, to establish those laws as given by God, all properly done. When those laws and that our Constitution reflects the fact that the states have sovereign law, when the states as a government oppose a federal law, it is every bit within the context of biblical order, and it is proper. And so we fall under, again, higher authority. So states really are the higher authority. Ultimately, the people hold the highest of power, but we must submit ourselves to civil government that is now there in place. So I don't want to get too complicated on that, but that's right.
Sure.
Higher authority, and the sovereign states have every right, biblically and constitutionally, set up to say no to any law by federal government that would supersede or violate their law according to their constitution or certainly
WFYL, King of Prussia.
Hold on, we just had a little glitch there. Go ahead, Sam. Sorry about that.
Well, anyway, I was just finishing on the point, so you can go ahead. I mean, so that really is the context. The states are formed under the law granted by the people. It is sovereign. And it is more. It has greater authority under their state constitutions than even what is in the U.S. Constitution, except what has been established there. So nullification, that from that perspective, or the ability to say no, the states have, and they are compliant constitutionally and biblically when they stand on those positions.
Which I think is a big relief for a lot of Christians. We got only a couple seconds here, Sam. I know you probably got to go. Thank you so much for joining us and your input this morning. We're going to continue our talking on nullification here. We're going to be back right after the news at 7:30. Thanks for joining us, everyone. We'll be right back after this. Good morning again, and welcome back to The Constitution Matters here on 1180 WFYL. Our topic, constitutional nullification this morning. Is it a viable way to affect change in our government when we have federal overreach? Thank you so much for joining us on this Friday morning. TGIF, by the way. Again, Mike Levin's here for you, and we also have Gary Porter on the phone. We just brought on David Whitney, who's going to be talking with us and going to be giving us some examples of modern-day implementation of nullification, if I'm all right to say that. Why don't we go ahead and just do some introductions. Of course, Gary Porter, Executive Director of the Constitution Leadership Initiative, and now joining us, David Whitney, Pastor and Senior Instructor at the Institute on the Constitution. How are you gentlemen both doing this morning?
Doing great. Thank you for having us on.
Nah, it's always a pleasure. So, David, why don't you go ahead and enlighten us We're going to jump right back into our topic here, but tell us about some of the modern day, again, implementation, if that word is appropriate, of nullification of the Constitution from the state's side.
Well, thank you. And actually, let me just broaden the topic a bit before we talk about what's happening with state legislatures right now, because there's another area of nullification that's really important for every citizen to know. It's not just your state legislature that should interpose when the federal government steps outside the boundaries of the U.S. Constitution and begins to legislate what, well, I guess should really be called unlaw. That's UNLAW, unlaw, something that's not lawful because they have no constitutional authority to do so. It's not just the state legislatures that do that, but it's the citizen, the individual citizen, when they serve as a juror. And usually they're not going to be told this by any court in our land because the courts don't want them to know they have this power of jury nullification. That is, their first duty is to look to see if the law that supposedly this fellow citizen has been dragged into court and been charged with violating the law, if the law itself is lawful. That is, if it is in accordance with the U.S. Constitution or their state constitution, and even in a bigger frame of reference, if it's in accordance with the laws of nature and nature's God, which, as the Declaration says, is the very foundation of our entire form of government. And juries have successfully in history nullified laws. And you might say, well, wait a minute, that's only one case. Yeah, in that one case, they stopped tyranny from taking place with their fellow citizen. But what happens when a series of juries again and again nullify a law that they say, this law is wrong, this law is just out of line, what can happen is the law itself can be useless. For example, consider the 18th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution, prohibition, saying that alcohol can't be produced, it can't be transported, and so on and so forth. Well, juries regularly and routinely began nullifying that amendment to the Constitution. So here, you know, not even using the constitutional standard, because obviously it was part of the Constitution, they were using the laws of nature and nature's God, God's word, for example. Wait a minute, didn't Jesus make wine? So Jesus would be in violation of the 18th Amendment. And juries concluded, my neighbor who's been dragged in by those revenuers and they busted down his still, he's been making moonshine for 40 years, and there's no reason why he should be prohibited from making moonshine because of this 18th Amendment. So juries began nullifying the 18th Amendment to the Constitution so regularly that prosecutors recognized they couldn't get convictions any longer. And so prosecutors stopped prosecuting people charged with violating the 18th Amendment, and eventually the whole nation recognized this is a bad idea to begin with. Let's get rid of it. Let's repeal the 18th Amendment. So nullification has taken place in our nation, even on the individual citizen level, and it has been very successful. Well, with the current overreach of our federal government and, wow, just every area of life, it's really breathtaking when you look at the number of ways our federal government is violating the Constitution. In fact, I think it was the Heritage Foundation did a study of what takes place in Washington, D.C., and this was a couple of years ago, so it's probably even worse today. But they determined that 90% of everything done by Congress and by the president was unconstitutional. 90% of everything coming out of Washington, D.C. was a violation of the Constitution. So it is high time for not only individual citizens, but more importantly, state legislatures to say, that's enough. We're not going to have that anymore. Consider Obamacare as one example. The state of Ohio actually amended their state constitution to say Obamacare was illegal in the state of Ohio. Now, there's been some problems with stepping up to the plate and actually doing what that amendment says, but that's, you know, holding their state elected officials accountable to
that. To me, expresses some dissatisfaction. Oh my goodness, I'm sounding like George W. Bush on some of his attempts to say some words out there. It sounds like they're not happy with that law, I would say. Just by writing something like that, that just comes off a little strong. I'm just saying that, a little tongue in cheek here. But anyway, go ahead. That was meant to just be a little input there. Go ahead, continue your train of thought there, David.
Thank you. Well, consider the Second Amendment, which, again, is a Brady Bill, and there's a whole long line of legislation. The federal government has attempted to restrict the people's right to keep and bear arms, and usually they've done it through the Commerce Clause, which is pretty peculiar. Wait a minute, the Commerce Clause and the Second Amendment, how do you... Anyway, they've combined it, say, well, any gun manufacturer is going to cross state lines, and when it crosses state lines, at some point later down the road, therefore, we can control the manufacturer of that gun because eventually it's going to cross state lines. They've said the same thing with ammunition and so forth. A number of states, I'll use Wyoming as an example, but there's a number of states that now have said, no, no, federal government, you don't get to do that. We're going to pass a state law that says if a gun or ammunition is manufactured within the boundaries of our state and sold within the boundaries of our state, in other words, the first sale, not when it's eventually crossing state lines, but the first sale from the manufacturer to whoever purchases it, that item, that gun or that ammunition, is not subject to any federal control or any federal regulation whatsoever. And several states, I think Montana is another state, and there's a couple other western states that have done a similar piece of legislation. They have not only done that in Wyoming, but they've actually put teeth in their bill. And this is the important thing that state legislators need to do. They need to be sure that there's subsequent penalties for federal officers who come into their state and violate that state law. And say, wait a minute, no, the federal law trumps the state law, and we're just going to impose the federal law. I think it was a $5,000 fine per incident, per federal official attempting to impose that, and even prison time was foreseen as a potential penalty in the Wyoming legislation. So they basically said, federal government, hands off. And by the way, it's been a boon for Wyoming because they have gun manufacturers moving from anti-gun states like Colorado. I just read about one of those companies moving up there to Cheyenne, Wyoming, or that area, because they recognize here's a government, a state government, willing to protect our God-given rights that are secured under the Second Amendment. And so it's an actual boon to the states that do that. So on the Second Amendment, there's a number of states who are taking the proper action to restrict the federal overreach and the federal violation. There's a whole bunch of legislation. And by the way, if you want to look at what's taking place and see what's happening, as well as have model legislation for your state, that is, you as a citizen might say, I don't know how to even approach this. Well, if you can hand to your state legislator, here's a model legislation on Second Amendment issues, and they can just do whatever modifications to that are necessary working from that model legislation. The 10th Amendment Center, it's just spelled out exactly like it sounds. The 10thAmendmentCenter.com has a excellent website tracking what's happening in those state capitals regarding these, as well as giving model legislation to help states move forward on this. Not only is the Second Amendment critically important, the Fourth Amendment. Oh, I heard the earlier part of the show talking about the federal overreach invading our privacy, invading our phone conversations, our email, and just vast invasions that are taking place from the NSA. Well, there's a number of pushbacks taking place in state legislatures seeking to protect Fourth Amendment guaranteed rights from the violations of the federal government. In fact, there's a couple of states trying to do pushback directly against NSA. What was attempted here in Maryland, my county here in Maryland is the one where the biggest spy agency in the world operates out of, NSA, and last year they ultimately backed away from it. There was a number of state legislators who said, you know what, NSA is quite obviously in violation of the Fourth Amendment to the U.S. Constitution. And until they comply with the Fourth Amendment to the Constitution, we as state legislators believe that we should cut off their electricity and their water. Whoa! There was a lot of pushback, and those legislators ultimately backed away from that. But in the state of Utah, that is
awesome. Wow! I can't believe that they have that right. You know, they are state. Right. They run those utilities. Wow! Talk about that. That's some teeth there. Those are some pretty sharp canines, actually.
The state of Utah, currently in session, their legislature is considering a similar thing for, I don't know if you've read and kept up with the details, but the huge data center that can store everybody's phone calls and not just the metadata, the content and so on. This huge facility built out there in Utah, well, the state legislature of Utah is considering the same thing. Let's cut off their electricity. Let's cut off their water. That would pretty quickly put them out of business there in their ongoing unconstitutional spying on Americans. And I know this is hard for all of us to get our mind around, because we assume the government does what it does lawfully. That, you know, the kind of baseline assumption is, of course, they're the government. They know the law better than we do as citizens, and therefore, if they think it's lawful, if they think it's constitutional to do these things, well, you know, who are we to quibble with them? They went to law school, and so they know the law. The reality is they don't. They don't know the Constitution, and they don't know, and therefore citizens like, you know, what Gary is doing in teaching the Constitution, or we're doing an Institute on the Constitution, are critical for us as citizens to know the law so that we can hold in check a federal government that's, you know, gone rogue. I guess the best way to put it is they've gone rogue.
Well, and
they
I
know
think
the Constitution doesn't allow them to do the things that they're doing.
Yeah, and I think that the beautiful thing about our government and the wisdom of the founding fathers and how they organized it was, and this is what a lot of people don't realize. I mean, pretty much every. I mean, I guess we could go back even to the ancient era, ancient Greece, if you will. They had true democracy, not necessarily a republic. And there's, of course, different, and you gentlemen probably know a lot more about that than I do. But as far as the course of history of governments goes, the majority of those governments are top down, to use a figure of speech. The founding fathers, in their wisdom in organizing our government, and this is what a lot of people don't realize, and if you think about it, it really becomes an information war at one point or another, that there was so much power given to the people, there was so much power given to the states, to where we can interpret the laws, and that is actually allowable by our governing document, the Constitution, to where we could interpret something as an individual or state and say, hey, this is not according to this larger governing document, which gives us rights to challenge that and to say we're not going to agree with that, or we have a right to change that. So that is, a lot of people don't realize that. They have mm-hmm. no idea that this is what the founding fathers, and I mean, that's again why we have shows like this, The Constitution Matters, because those rights do rest with the people, is a phrase that's been said on this station before. It's we the people that matter. Gary, you know, yep. I know you were writing some of your writings about whether nullification is effective or not. If you got somewhere else you want to go for it. But
well, yeah, David is quite right. I mean, there have been some great successes, and nullification is a legitimate tool, a very powerful tool, and it's been used with great success in some instances. It needs to be continued to. But there are some limitations to it that we must understand as well. And one of the biggest ones is that nullification does not change the underlying federal law. It doesn't repeal the law. So the law still exists on the books, perhaps not as effective as the lawmakers would like it to be, but it doesn't repeal the law. And nullification is only a state-by-state issue. That is, if Wyoming nullifies federal gun laws, that doesn't help the residents of California at all. Now, you could argue that the residents of California need to get their act together and need to convince their state legislature to do something similar. But the point is, nullification is a single-state, single-issue enterprise. So think about, David mentioned that the Heritage Foundation thought that 90% of what the federal government is currently doing is unconstitutional. Well, consider how long it would take us to nullify 90% of the legislation that comes out of in a particular year. It's going to take a long time, and perhaps we may never get all of those laws nullified at the state level, and of course it only affects the residents of that one state. Now, the next limitation of nullification is that it can be reversed by the next state legislature that takes its seats. In other words, if next week Virginia's legislature decides to nullify some issue, 2 years from now when we have a new state legislature, they can easily repeal that earlier law, and therefore that nullifies the nullification, so to speak, and it's only really a transitory or a temporary situation to make a point that there's been an overreach on the federal government's part, and we take issue to it. Now, another limitation is that nullification only affects state resources. As the state can only say, we are not going to help the federal government enforce this law, which we feel to be unconstitutional. We're not going to commit any state resources to the enforcement of the law. Now, the federal government is still, because the law still exists on the books, the federal government is still within its own resources able to enforce that law to the extent it is able. Now, Wyoming says that if any federal agent comes into their state to enforce that law, they're going to be subject to civil penalties, and that's a great step in the right direction. But there may be other ways that the federal government can enforce that law. So nullification has a limitation there as well. And the final limitation that I want to mention is regarding the courts. Nullification doesn't have a very good track record in the courts. And the Supreme Court has on a couple occasions taken up the issue. In 1850, Wisconsin tried to declare the Fugitive Slave Act to be unconstitutional and null and void in their state. And the Supreme Court in Appleman versus Booth declared that Wisconsin did not have the right or the power to declare the Fugitive Slave Act nullified or of no effect. Later on in 1958, in Cooper v. Aaron, the court declared that Arkansas, which was trying to amend its constitution in a way that will allow it to oppose desegregation, did not have the power to do that. So there have been a couple cases at least, only two really at the Supreme Court level, but others at lower courts, that have taken a pretty dim view of nullification. Now, we can make a case from natural law. Blackstone certainly would have subscribed to it, and in fact he did. He said that all civil laws, if they contravene a natural law, are of no effect. They have no force. So we can make a case from that, but then you encounter a court that doesn't agree that there is even exists a natural law.
Right. In today's postmodern society, too, a lot of people would even contest that and say that natural laws themselves are not definite. Which, again, that's the society. Not saying that that is necessarily the answer, because I think we could all agree that it's not, but.
Natural laws were composed by God, by the Creator.
Right.
At the same time, He created everything. So, if a natural law is going to be repealed, God's got to do it.
Right, and it's funny, you know, you brought up the courts. It's like, well, they could, you know, it's almost like basically what I was hearing was the courts basically can just fly in the face of whatever they want, which kind of reflects our society. Again, that postmodern man can make his own laws, which if you're looking at it from a Christian's perspective, that honestly, that goes all the way back to the garden. If you think about it, we could be higher than God. You know, we make our own laws that are above natural law. I mean, that's just, that's it right there. It doesn't go any deeper.
Yeah.
Yep.
You know, and I would add to Gary's list of difficulties with nullification, the ultimate one that I think stops many states in their tracks from doing acts of nullification when they recognize there's a whole long range of things that they could do to stop federal overreach, but many states will not do it because they look at the situation and say, I know where my money is coming from. I receive millions upon millions and hundreds of millions of dollars in federal grants, some states maybe even $1 billion of federal grants, and it's like, No, if we go against the federal government, we're going to lose that money. And so I think the solution really has to do with getting back to constitutional taxation, which when we look at Article 1, Section 9, Clause 2, it prohibits capitation taxes upon the citizens of these United States. That is, if you're a citizen of one of the states in the Union, the federal government cannot reach out and tax you directly. It's forbidden. I.e., what the IRS today is doing is forbidden by our Constitution. And the excuse is, well, wait a minute, the 16th Amendment changed that? No, it did not. Study the case Breshaber v. Union Pacific and other Supreme Court cases following the ratification of the 16th, and they explicitly declare the 16th Amendment granted no new taxing powers to the federal government. Therefore, if the federal government couldn't do it before the 16th Amendment, it can't do it after the 16th Amendment. And there had been some state legislators, one of our heroes who's now with the Lord, Bobby Franklin, down there in, in Georgia who proposed legislation that would basically get back to that constitutional taxation system whereby the federal government doesn't tax you directly. If there is some direct tax, it must be done constitutionally. That is, the states gather the funds from the people in their state for paying the federal tax. In other words, the tax bill doesn't come to the individual citizen. It comes to the state government. And as the Constitution clearly states, each state proportionally, based on the census, is given a portion of the federal tax bill. So Maryland has $5 million, let's say, and, oh, let's pick Indiana, has $10 million. The state of Indiana would have twice the size of a tax bill as the state of Maryland because it's twice as large in terms of population. The states themselves will be the tax collectors for that particular federal tax that is to be paid. And this system that existed before, you know, the IRS brought about this change, this gave the states and the citizens enormous power over the taxing process because the citizens could vote out their legislators if they didn't like the way their state was collecting their state taxes. And Bobby Franklin's proposal in Georgia, it did not pass both houses, so it was not signed into law, would have basically put the IRS out of business in the state of Georgia. The people of Georgia would have had to fill out their tax forms, and their checks and so forth would be written to the state treasury of Georgia, not to the IRS.
Well, and imagine what would happen, though, if all of a sudden people stopped sending their taxes to the IRS. I mean, immediately there would
starve the beast. The beast would starve.
Right, but and there would also be conflict. You know, whatever that may look like, whether it's in the courts or which, you know, it's interesting because of all these laws, you know, these are laws, the Constitution. It's how this country is governed. Merely people are afraid to hold up the law.
Part of the problem is that we don't like conflict. We like a nice ordered life, and we try to avoid conflict. But there's a time when you need to stand up and say enough is enough. And so, yes, nullification is going to introduce a constitutional crisis in a way that it institutes a balance of power argument as to who has the right here to do what they're doing. But we need to have those kinds of discussions. We need to have those issues out in the forefront so that we, the people, the owners of the document, can come to an agreement about this. But there's this tendency to avoid conflict, to keep the waters smooth and avoid any ripples. And we need to get beyond that.
Yeah, and look where it's gotten us in a lot of ways. And in some ways, it's because people, you know, may not handle conflict healthily, you know, in a healthy manner. But, you know, because there's a healthy way to manage conflict as well. It's where we're at. And
one thing the individual citizen could do is to take our jury course. I know that down there in Virginia, Gary is planning to do that jury course here at Pasadena, Maryland. We are planning to do the jury course, and we're going to make it available online. So if people want to go to our website, theamericanview.com, they can take it online or take it in person. And Gary, I guess you're offering it in person, but not online. I don't remember the details there.
Yeah, it's just going to be a one-day seminar on the 31st of January down here in Yorktown. So if there's any listeners that are in the local area, they could take advantage of that by contacting me. But it'll just be local.
All right, and they could contact you.
It'll be online on Thursday nights from 7 to 9, so encourage people to go to our website, theamericanview.com, and sign up for the jury course.
Excellent. Theamericanview.com. Go ahead and get educated. As always, stay informed. We're at the end of our program. Gentlemen, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And
God
thank
bless.
You. The Constitution matters.
See you next week.